Okay, let's check that blood pressure. Okay, then.
Well, what is it?
131 over 95.
Is that good? I never understand blood pressure numbers. What does that one mean?
It's not horrible.
What would be good?
120 over 80.
Okay, check it again. I'm going to try to get that.
It doesn't work that way. In fact, the more you try to will yourself to get a low blood pressure, the more
check
you...
Check it again, Dumbo. Watch me nail this sucker.
One 50 over 103. See?
Oh my God, I'm dying.
Certainly not. But you're getting all upset about your blood pressure, which is making your blood pressure go up.
Okay, all right. Deep, cleansing breath. I am not upset about my blood pressure. I am not upset about my blood pressure. Okay, do it right now. I think I'm really super relaxed.
161 over 108. Look, we need to stop.
Stop? I'm having a stroke. Nobody can leave this room until my blood pressure goes down. I was completely healthy until I had my blood pressure checked, and now I'm dying here.
No, you're not. Your blood pressure was a little high because you're not used to having it checked. And then it went higher because you were upset about your blood pressure. And then it went even higher because you were upset about the effect on your blood pressure of being upset.
Then I can never really know my real blood pressure, right?
There is a clinic in Norway where they use hypnosis, past life regression, simulated Viking activities, and equipment disguised as friendly animals to take your blood pressure without your knowing it.
For serious? I am totally going. I've always wanted to see Stockholm.
That's in Sweden.
Don't upset me. That just gets my blood pressure up. Are you trying to kill me? Today's show is all about blood pressure. And now he treated his hypertension with leeches. And now they all have high blood pressure. Colin McEnroe.
That's right. Nobody thinks about the leeches. What happens to them when they suck your high blood pressure blood? See, I can't even say it. It doesn't work that way either. We're going to tell you a little bit, or maybe a lot, today about blood pressure and how it works. I promised a long time ago we'd do a whole show about blood pressure. That's sort of true, but we're going to look at some other things today, too, especially because there's been a new set of guidelines put out by the American Heart Association, and that set of guidelines has been an occasion for a certain amount of controversy, even within the medical profession. Are these the right guidelines? Do they lead to the right kinds of treatment? So if you've been reading about that or sort of following it out of the corner of your eye, we'll try to explain to you what that's all about. But we are going to also tell you a lot about blood pressure, about what it is, how it's checked, and why it's possible that you may be on the wrong drug, if you're taking a drug at all, or that you may need a drug that you're not taking, and there's a whole sort of menu of options, and many of them have led you possibly to the wrong conclusion. And I would just say, if you're out there in your 20s listening and thinking, this has nothing to do with me, well, that's probably true, but not absolutely true, and it probably has something to do with mom or dad or somebody in your life, so you might want to keep listening. 860-275-7266 as we go along. You may have questions. 860-275-7266. We have experts. They are not allowed to diagnose you or cure you on the air, though. That would be bad medicine. But if you have sort of general questions or comments, 860-275-7266, and you may tweet us at WNPRColin. So let me introduce you. First of all, we're going to get to him in just a second. You've met him before, actually. Dr. Samuel Mann is a professor of clinical medicine and a specialist in hypertension at New York Presbyterian Weill Cornell Medical Center. He's the author of the book Hypertension and You, a book I rarely have far from my side, except I've lost my copy over the last 10 minutes. But it's somewhere here. It's somewhere here in the building. I know that. He'll be joining us in just a second sort of to really kind of get into the blood pressure and stroke part of all this. But also with us in studio, Dr. Paul Thompson. He's the chief of cardiology at Hartford Hospital. We thought we'd lead off with him just because this has been so much in the news. I mean, it's been so much in the news if you're the kind of person who reads articles about cardiovascular health and guidelines and stuff like that. I'm not saying it's been blasted all over page one, but there's been a lot about it. And so, Dr. Thompson, first of all, just, you know, to come and kind of thumbnail this, I think most people, if they know anything about it at all, they know that as the result of a multi-year study, the American Heart Association came out with a new set of guidelines, and that it's sort of you sort of break it into two categories. One of them is a new instrument kind of for evaluating cardiovascular risk. And then sort of that having been done, a new set of ways to make decisions about who to treat and how to treat based on how they respond to this risk assessment. But maybe you can say a little bit more. I mean, how revolutionary, how different is this?
So they're really not that revolutionary, and they're not that markedly different. So what's happened is that there is this new way of estimating risk. Now, it's interesting. The risk we estimate is only for the next 10 years. Mm-hmm. And I don't know about you, but I don't want to live only the next 10 years. So one of the problems with any risk estimator is that most of us want to know our risk not over the next 10 years, but over the next 20 or even 30 years, depending on how young we are. But these are not necessarily revolutionary. Now, the other thing is it's not just one study. What they really are is they're these new guidelines are a compilation of many studies. And what they say is the following. Those people who have known heart disease, they ought to be treated with cholesterol-lowering drugs. Those people who have diabetes, they ought to be treated because people with diabetes are at high risk. Those people who have a risk that's calculated as more than 7% over the next 10 years. Mm. And then a lot of decision is made with your physician. So I think one of the take-home messages that we all should make is that you do not want to get your medical care through the newspaper or even through the radio.
True. A lot of what people did get through the newspaper or through the radio was, for example, one of the big takeaways was if every doctor and patient followed these guidelines more or less to the letter, a lot more people would be on statins than are currently on statins. How fair is that?
So that's a bit of a debate. That's a bit of a debate because some people say it will lower the number of people who are on statins. Others say that it will increase the number who are on statins. I personally think it will increase the number of people that are on statins. Now, people out there are going to say, well, that's a terrible thing. But it isn't such a terrible thing. And it isn't such a terrible thing because if you look at a series of drugs or a class of drugs that have reduced the risk of heart disease remarkably, statins are remarkable in terms of their reducing the risk of heart disease. Now, they're not without risk totally. About 5% of people will get some muscle aching out of it. Some people will think that they affect their memory, although that's debated as well. We have a study at Hartford Hospital that's actually looking at whether they affect that. But many of us don't think it's such a bad thing that more people are treated with cholesterol drugs. Now, here's what a lot of people say. Well, you're doing it the wrong way. You're using a drug. You should be doing it by diet. You should be doing it by exercise and weight loss. The problem is that most people aren't able to do the diet weight loss stuff to get where they need to get. So what do you want to do? Do you want to punish them by letting them have heart disease, or do you want to treat them with these drugs so that they don't get heart disease? Obviously, the committee that put together these guidelines decided to treat them so that they didn't get heart disease.
The other thing that I think a lot of people found confusing, I found it confusing reading about this, while we're on the subject of the statins anyway, one of the things that I found confusing was it seemed to be saying, what I was reading seemed to be saying, I mean, for example, okay, I'm on a statin. Why am I on a statin? Because when my doctor, Jack, does lab panels, you know, I had high cholesterol. And this went on over a period of time. And we looked at it and we decided I would go on a statin. I went on the statin. And then he just continued to measure my cholesterol. And my cholesterol went down. And so we know the cholesterol is working. We know the statin is working. And this this new model, on the one hand, it's more holistic and global. It looks at a lot of different things. But the way that it was reported back, it almost reported back as though Jack wouldn't necessarily be checking my cholesterol all the time anymore, even though I'm on a statin.
Colin, you're exactly right. And one of the things that they did is they eliminated this concept of goal. Now, that shows you the difference between the people who wrote the guidelines, who are primarily public health people. You know, if you're a public health doctor, what you do is you immunize the whole community so that the whole community doesn't get polio or diphtheria or something else. If you're a physician, you take care of an individual patient. And I will frequently say to a patient, I need you to lose 6 pounds in the next 6 months. I give them a goal. So it's a different philosophy between the physician that takes care of an individual patient, where you often use and give goals, and the public health doctors who kind of treat everybody and don't worry so much about the goals. Now, here's the main rub. The main rub is that it was decided early on in writing these guidelines that they would only depend on the best evidence. And the best evidence is a randomized controlled trial. People get a placebo, people get a drug, they're followed for 5 years. And there are no randomized controlled trials looking at goals. But goals still make sense. And so most of us who take care of suffering mankind will continue to use those goals in treatment and continue to measure you to make sure that you've made what we think you should be as a goal.
It's sort of What you just said, I'm going to bring Dr. Mann into the conversation pretty quickly here, but what you just said also helps me maybe understand one of the other criticisms of this study. No sooner had this study and this set of American Heart Association guidelines come out, but another report came out, I think, from
Paul Ritker in Boston.
Yeah, Paul Ritker in Boston, saying these things, they overestimate risk by a huge factor, maybe 75-100% overestimation of risk. Now, what you just said, if it's sort of a public health study, you want to sort of take the risk of treating people who aren't all that sick in order to kind of get everybody. Is that part of the problem?
Well, they made a big deal about the fact that these guidelines overestimate risk, but they've always overestimated risk. And that's because they're based on such things as the Framingham study. Now, not just on the Framingham study, but partly on the Framingham study. And what's happened over time is that people's risk has gone down over time. Now, the other thing to remember is that these risk calculations are made off of certain populations who volunteer to participate in these studies. People who participated in studies, believe it or not, live longer, do better than people who don't participate in studies. So even though this risk estimate overestimates risk for certain populations, it probably doesn't overestimate that much for the whole population. But we've known for years. I'm surprised it was made such a big thing of in the New York Times and all that, because we've known for years that the risk is overestimated by these equations.
All right. We've got some calls coming in. We're going to get to those calls. And we're talking to Dr. Paul Thompson. He's the chief of cardiology at Hartford Hospital. He's with us the whole way. So is Dr. Samuel Mann. Dr. Samuel Mann is, as I said, professor of clinical medicine, specialist in hypertension at New York Presbyterian Weill Cornell Medical Center, and the author of the book Hypertension and You. He's been on our show before. I think we're talking about salt that time. I wanted to have a more comprehensive conversation about blood pressure. But before we do that, Dr. Mann, I wanted to take your temperature, as it were, about the AHA guidelines. And just, you know, as a way in, I mean, I'm imagining there may be some things about these guidelines that you have some questions or doubts about. But if I understood the reporting correctly, one good thing about this set of guidelines is it brought stroke in with heart attack together in a way that maybe guidelines previously had not done. Do I have that right?
I'm not quite getting that last point. Good afternoon, and good afternoon, Dr. Thompson. I'm not getting your last question, although very much there's an analogy with our treatment of cholesterol and our treatment of blood pressure. Mm. And a lot of patients with blood pressure, if somebody's 40 years old and hypertensive, I will treat them even though their risk of an event in the next 10 years might be 1%. I'm more concerned with risks 20, 30 years down the road. And I agree with Dr. Thompson. A lot of our patients don't have that amount of risk and yet need treatment to prevent 30 events 30 years later. And we're not just talking, everybody talks about stroke and heart attack and kidney disease, which is all true, but I'm looking at that 40-year-old, and perhaps similarly with the cholesterol, I'm looking at cognitive status when somebody reaches 70 and 80 years old, and there's more and more evidence that, quote, Alzheimer's disease, a lot of that is really vascular disease, and we don't have good trials of 30 years of blood pressure or cholesterol treatment and its effect on losing cognitive function 30 years later. That's one of the reasons I treat blood pressure even without being at high risk. And there are other examples of complications. So, I, as a physician, and I'm sure Dr. Thompson feels the same way, you're looking at the patient in your room. There are guidelines, but with that patient, if I know his father died at 40 of a heart attack, nothing else matters. I'm treating that patient. So guidelines are nice, but physicians have to go by their gut instincts and what their experience tells them in combination with the guidelines.
Yeah, Dr. Thompson, go ahead.
And Colin, that's one of the things that's stressed in the new guidelines. Now, you can make criticism of the guidelines, but they do stress the fact that the decision should be made in conjunction with a good physician like Dr. Mann. By the way, Dr. Mann, I've always admired your contributions with respect to hypertension.
Thank you.
But it's very important that this be done in conjunction with a physician who's looking at your overall risk. And I totally agree, the next 10 years is not enough. So when you're taking care of somebody long term, you want to prevent those events that are going to happen 30 years downstream. We now know that a lot of people that we think have had Alzheimer's disease, actually what they have is small cholesterol crystals that get flicked off of either the aorta or someplace else. And it over a period of time creates what Dr. Mann referred to as vascular dementia.
You know, let me just sort of address one of the concerns that people have about this. And I think one of the other ways the landscape has changed is it used to be that there would be medical reporting in medical journals, and there would be then coverage of that in the scientific press and in the New York Times. Now, of course, with the digital landscape, you can go online and read all kinds of things and read all kinds of interpretations of a study or a set of guidelines like the one we're talking about. And I didn't have to look very far before I found websites where they were basically saying this is simply a massive payday for drug companies, that you know, that they had enough money in this study one way or another, or the doctors doing the study had been funded in the past by them enough so that they had a vested interest in creating a set of answers that put a lot of people on drugs that they may or may not need. So, you know, and it's not necessarily the way the mainstream press is reporting it, but people who are going online looking for information, they'll find stuff like that. So, Dr. Mann, I'll let you respond to that first.
Okay, the question is how much of this recommendation for using more and more drugs is driven by conflict of interest in terms of big pharma. And there are many studies, and when we talk about evidence-based medicine, if a lot of the evidence is based on studies that are sponsored by a pharmaceutical company, there's a definite conflict of interests. And I think that's a very important question. In hypertension right now, we're in a different place than the cholesterol. Again, they're analogous in many ways. One difference now is that more and more the hypertension drugs are generic. So there's less skin in the games for the pharmaceuticals, and therefore a little more reliability in the findings that are coming out. But in the years when there were lots of new drugs coming out, there was an absolute conflict of interest which assured that the newer drugs were going to get the most attention and the most positive attention. And you're absolutely right on that.
Dr. Thompson, I'll also let you comment on that. I mean, my understanding is the people who did this study actually worked for free, but then they weren't born the day they started working on the study either.
Right, but remember, this is not a study. It's a guideline consensus statement. So what it did is it went back and looked at all the studies that were published since 1991, and many of those studies that were published since 1991 were actually funded by the drug companies that made these medications, because there's nobody else that's going to put the money into doing these studies. But the data is overwhelming, or the data are overwhelming. There's so much evidence that statins reduce the risk of heart disease. They cause the cholesterol plaques to get less. So, I mean, I don't know many cardiologists that aren't themselves on a statin, to tell you the truth. And I think people vote, you know, they vote with their feet, as you say.
Right, and I want to second that. I fully agree. The drugs we have today are terrific. And there are actually some older drugs that are also terrific that don't get studied the way the newer drugs do, so they get lost in the shuffle. And one of the points I make in the book is we have some fabulous older medicines that are being forgotten. But there's no question that the risk of stroke and hypertension and cholesterol, the benefit is without doubt huge in what it's done for people in this generation.
Yeah, Colin, if you look at since 1964, which just happens to coincide with the Surgeon General's report on smoking, but if you look at since 1964, there has been a steady decline in the risk of heart disease and the risk of stroke, some of it due to smoking cessation, some of it due to other things. But despite the fact that the population is getting heavier, that diabetes is more prevalent, people are doing better, partly because of these new medications we have for both blood pressure, hypertension, and other things.
I should say, since we're talking about what the cardiologists take, I take simvastatin. I also take lisinopril. We'll talk about that in the blood pressure segment, though. All right, so we'll take a little break. That's what we'll take right now. 860-275-7266. People are already calling in with questions. 860-275-7266. More cardiovascular health for you after this. Blood pressure. All right. We're talking about cardiovascular health today. We're talking about blood pressure. We're also talking about the AHA guidelines. With us in studio, Dr. Paul Thompson, who's chief of cardiology at Hartford Hospital. With us on the phone is Dr. Samuel Mann, a professor of clinical medicine and a specialist in hypertension at New York Presbyterian Weill Cornell Medical Center. He's the author of the book Hypertension and You. We are happy to take your phone calls. Some are coming in, 860-275-7266, 860-275-7266. So I'll start with you, Dr. Thompson. We talked about the guidelines and how part of the guidelines involve a more complicated risk assessment, which really kind of involves taking a history, really knowing a lot about the patient, ranging from race and ethnicity to family history, background, things like that. At a certain point, my doctor, after he's done that, is going to do some tests, and he's going to run a lab panel. He's going to get my cholesterol readings. We talked about that. He's also, really the first thing that happens when you walk in a doctor's office, any kind of doctor's office these days, is they take your blood pressure. What are they measuring? What is blood pressure?
So blood pressure is simply the pressure that's generated every time that your heart makes a squeeze. So that's the top number, systolic. I always remember superior, the S for superior for systolic. And then we also measure the diastolic blood pressure, or the lower number. You're basically measuring the force that's exerted on those arteries. Now, the reason that's important is that the higher your blood pressure, the more work your heart has to do to eject blood. So over a period of time, that can actually thicken the heart and can lead to the fact that when you're older, some of these people have a heart that's too thick and doesn't relax well enough, and so they get what we call heart failure. But that heart failure is not because the heart doesn't squeeze enough. It's because the heart doesn't relax enough. So that's the sort of stuff that we're measuring. We're measuring your systolic or top and diastolic or down blood pressure.
Now, Dr. Mann, reading your book, I think what most people think that hypertension is one thing, it's something. And once you know you have it, you take a medication that treats it. Reading your book, I get the sense hypertension actually is a bunch of different possible things, and there's a bunch of different possible drugs that one might take to try to control it. Can you say a little bit more about that?
Sure. The blood pressure, or elevated blood pressure, is a common endpoint of different mechanisms that lead to it. So even though there's one diagnosis, hypertension or essential hypertension, there are different causes. It may be related to the kidneys. Maybe the kidneys hold on to sodium and fluid. Maybe the kidneys produce an excess of a hormone, renin, that leads to constriction of arteries. Maybe it's from the brain, and there you're talking about the sympathetic nervous system, which affects heart rate and blood pressure, and to a large extent is affected by emotion. And that leads to the question of the mind-body connection, which is a fascinating topic in hypertension. As a hypertension specialist, I would say about 90% of hypertension is from the kidney, those two mechanisms that we've discussed, and maybe about 10% is related to the sympathetic nervous system. So that's the simple picture. And then we have different drugs that target different causes. We have drugs that target the retention of sodium and volume. We have drugs that target the renin-angiotensin system. That's the kidney hormone. Drugs like the ACE inhibitors and the angiotensin antagonists. And we also have drugs that block the effects of the sympathetic nervous system. So in any patient, we have a choice of drugs depending on which mechanism we think is driving the hypertension in that individual. So it gets away from the idea of one size fits all. I wouldn't prescribe the same drug to everybody. I prescribe different drugs to different people.
And in your book, you say a lot of people are on the wrong drugs, wrong dosages of drugs, wrong combinations of drugs. And maybe we can get into that a little bit as we go along here. I want to go to the phones here pretty quickly just because one of the callers, I think, can only stay for a limited time. But June, if you could just hang on for 2 seconds, I think it's sort of worth spending a moment on the whole question of measurement. I'm going to start with you, Dr. Paul Thompson. When I go to my primary care physician, as I say, the first thing they do, obviously, just about the first thing they do most times, is take my blood pressure. Now, that's a snapshot, right? It's only going to tell them what my blood pressure is right at that moment when they're taking my blood pressure. So I'll start with you, Dr. Paul Thompson. How does that compare with is that enough information about my blood pressure?
So for some people, it is enough information. In other words, if the pressure is quite high, we know that the pressure is quite high. But for a lot of people with kind of borderline measurements, they have what we call white coat hypertension, meaning that in stressful situations, like seeing the white-coated physician, their blood pressure goes up. So that person may need a longer measurement period like with home monitoring or what we call an ambulatory blood pressure measurement. But what you're pointing to is a very important thing, and that is that there are mistakes that can be made in measuring blood pressure. For example, you can use too small a cuff, which will raise the blood pressure. Some devices in some doctor's offices aren't actually accurate. The best device is actually mercury, but many hospitals and places have pulled mercury out of the measurement stream because people are afraid of mercury, even though it's the elemental mercury and whatever. So there are, you know, it's a simple measurement, but it's not so simple to make all the decisions that we have to make. But I would defer to Dr. Mann on that. He's really one of the world's experts.
Well, you know, Dr. Mann, I'm sitting here actually in the studio. I brought in my Omron home blood pressure monitor. And one of the things that I've discovered using this thing, first of all, I've discovered, and this is in your book, that you can kind of get addicted to checking your blood pressure, which is not a good thing. We could talk a little bit about that. But the other thing I've noticed is my blood pressure is really different at different times of day. It's, you know, it tends to be very low in the morning, and it'll often go up. It'll even spike a little bit alarmingly sometimes in the late afternoon. It's a moving, changing animal. And I have so many questions about that, ranging from starting with what's my real blood pressure? Is it the 115 over 75 that I get at 10 o'clock in the morning? Or is it, you know, the 100 over 95 or, I mean, the 135 over 95 or even higher that I might get in the late afternoon? If your blood pressure changes all the time, what's your real blood pressure?
Well, that's a very, very crucial question. And what often is not adequately recognized is that everybody's pressure varies, some more, some less, but everybody's pressure varies. And if you want to know the true blood pressure, you do need an average of readings over time. So if I have a patient whose blood pressure is mostly normal and once in a while it's elevated, I'm not going to increase his or her medication. I do want to know what the blood pressure, though, is over time. And one problem, as you've been discussing, you come to the doctor's office. Number one, you have the problem of white coat. Some people, they're nervous, their pressure's higher in the doctor's office. They go home and check their pressure. It's perfectly normal. In that case, which reading would I believe, the high reading in my office or the normal reading at home? I'll generally go by the normal reading at home, although I'll ask them to bring in the monitor to the office to check so I can check it and make sure it's accurate. So that's one problem. And interestingly, some people who will insist they're not nervous in the doctor's office can also get that white coat phenomenon and get quite an elevation. And when you talk about the degree of elevation, one patient I saw yesterday, her pressure is about 200 over 100 in the doctor's office and about 125 at home. And she's been doing this for years and years. She's now 91. So it's fascinating what goes on with that.
All right. So do we know that it didn't, she's basically made it to the finish line there, that the blood pressure didn't kill her? And there is kind of the opposite, too. I think I may have the opposite. I feel pretty safe at the doctor's office. I feel like if anything should go wrong with me in the doctor's office, I'm at the doctor's office. So my blood pressure is often pretty low there, and I often have a hard time convincing the doctors, oh, no, when I go home, you know, it actually may go up quite a bit.
Yeah. It's called masked hypertension, and that's the opposite. People whose pressure is normal at the doctor's office and high at home. And it could be one of two things. Either at home they have that alerting phenomenon. They're nervous about their pressure when they check it at home. And just like some people, the pressure goes up when they see the doctor, some people the pressure goes up when they check it at home. The other possibility is I ask the patient, how did they get here? And if they tell me they hurried, they walked a fast mile and a half to get to me, and now they're sitting down for 5 minutes, their pressure may be lower than its usual. After walking a brisk mile, it's almost gaming the system to get a good reading. The other problem is, and I'm doing a study right now, looking at how people check their pressure at home and how it's checked in the doctor's office, probably about half, maybe more, the pressure is done incorrectly, and decisions are made based on those. And in doctor's office, I'll tell you two of the most common issues. One problem is a doctor will come in, talk to the patient, immediately check the pressure rather than having the patient wait for 5 minutes. And all the epidemiologic data and studies in terms of how it affects outcome of strokes and all that are based on the resting blood pressure. And the doctor should have the patient sit in a chair for 5 minutes before checking the pressure. And in these busy, pressured times, a lot of doctors don't do that. That's one problem. Another problem, when I check a patient's pressure, I have them sitting and I have them sitting quietly. Just the act of talking can raise the pressure 5, 10, 20 millimeters. I'm not having a conversation with the patient when I'm checking his pressure. I'm having him sit quietly. Third problem, the electronic blood pressure cuffs that they have now, they're pretty accurate, but they take so damn long. It takes about a minute to get a reading, and you can't sit there and get three readings. And the guidelines tell you to get two or three readings in the doctor's office or at home. And if you have an automated machine that gets one reading and you don't have the time or patience to do it again and again, you're getting that one moment in time, even though the pressure the next minute is going to be different. You can't average a few readings, which is very important. So there are so many aspects to measuring pressure that determine who needs treatment and who doesn't.
There are a lot, and we won't be able to cover them all today. I just because she's in a bit of a rush, I'm going to that's not good for her blood pressure to be in a bit of a rush. But here's June from Farmington with either a question or a comment. Hi, June.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I am on, just as an overview, I am on Toprol, Lipitor, and Coumadin. And everything is under control, and I monitor myself very carefully. However, I just read something that made me have some concern about the Toprol, and that is a letter that I read in The Current about a person on lisinopril who had hoarseness and nagging cough. Now, the love of my life is singing, and mysteriously, my voice just disappeared about 3 years ago. I don't know if it correlates to the time that I went on Toprol or not, but how do you feel about that? Is that a possibility that I've lost my... I've had my voice checked, but...
Yeah. All right. You sound audible anyway. You didn't completely lose your voice. I don't know. Does anybody want to take?
So, Sam, I'll make a quick comment, but I don't think it could be related to the Toprol, to tell you the truth. It may be, but I don't think so. There are other things that can cause you to have changes in your voice, such as thyroid changes and things like that, and that ought to be looked into. But generally, the problem with voice and cough, and that is restricted to a group of drugs called the ACE inhibitors. Would you agree, Dr. Mann?
Absolutely.
All right, so I want to talk a little bit about exercise. You know, one of the things you're going to read anytime you read about cardiovascular health, about blood pressure, about anything, is that exercise is really good. And I've even read the line that sweat, human sweat, is the best anti-hypertension drug. For a lot of people, they feel it sort of in a double bind. If they're already presenting with some risk factors, some cardiovascular risk factors, maybe they're overweight, so they need to exercise. Maybe they've got some other risk factors there. One of the things they know is that they're supposed to exercise, but they also assume that there must be some risk. They're afraid to exercise as well because they feel as though they're at risk. So I'm going to start with you, Dr. Thompson. How do you help your patients understand that? Obviously, if you exercise, your heart rate's going to go up, your blood pressure's going to go up, all kinds of things are going to go up that you don't ordinarily want going up.
So overall, exercise reduces the risk of heart disease. Now, when you're actually engaged in very vigorous exercise, the risk of having a heart problem goes up while you're doing the exercise. So I always say it's like buying stock in the stock market. You're looking for a long-term gain, but the market could crash tomorrow and you'd lose it, okay? So there's long-term benefits from exercise. So what I say to my patients, especially if they're overweight and especially if they have high blood pressure or diabetes, that I want them to walk briskly a minimum of 30 minutes every day, and I'd prefer an hour. Now, if you go for a vigorous walk in the morning, and Linda Pescatello at UConn has been one of our collaborators on these studies, your blood pressure is actually lower for about the next 10 or 12 hours. An acute exercise bout kind of resets your blood pressure, and it lowers it for about 10 to 12 hours. And those effects are almost as good as you can get with low dose of blood pressure medicines. So one of the things you can do is walk vigorously in the morning and walk vigorously in the evening, and you've covered yourself for almost the whole day. The thing that people need to understand is you don't have to get into great shape to have the benefits of exercise. Blood sugar levels get better, triglycerides get better, one of the blood fats, and blood pressure gets better just from a single exercise session. Now, about the risk, I tell them to start slowly and to progress gradually. One more thing about exercise. If somebody's overweight, if that overweight person walks a mile, they use more calories than a thin person walking a mile. So exercise for somebody who's overweight is a great way to lose weight. They've got a restrict diet as well, but it's a great way to burn up those calories because they use more calories per walking mile than a thin person. It's a way to make lemonade, so to speak, out of your lemon.
Dr. Mann, this is something you do address in your book. But, I mean, for people who have any kind of blood pressure risk or who occasionally get a high blood pressure reading or something like that, once again, as I mean, he's addressed a lot of it. But that idea of going to the gym can be a little bit scary for that person. You know, if I'm jacking my blood pressure up to 180, I'm thinking, how could that be good for me?
Right. I would say two things. First of all, I would not recommend vigorous exercise for somebody whose blood pressure is way out of control. I'm proud to say that my patients almost all have a controlled blood pressure, and when the pressure is controlled or near controlled, I am not worried about their exercising. I agree with everything Dr. Thompson said, and for all the things that are controversial in medicine, one thing that every single study shows is that exercise reduces cardiovascular events by about 50%. So it is important. Question of which exercise, there's no one that's better than another. To me, the best one is the one the patient's willing to do, because then they'll do it. I'm not crazy about the unexercised 250-pound 60-year-old man deciding to run, because he's bound to create orthopedic problems. And running is not necessarily the best. Brisk walking would be better. But generally, if the blood pressure is controlled, there's no problem. Keep in mind also, somebody who has a perfectly normal blood pressure, who's lifting weights, his pressure can go up to 230. And that's in a person with a perfectly normal blood pressure. So the rise in blood pressure during exercise normally is not a health problem, and every study shows it benefits them in the long run. On the other hand, if somebody has coronary disease in a narrowed vessel, then there's a slightly increased risk of event during exercise, and that's about the coronary disease. But in general, every study shows benefit.
Quick call here from Carl and Yvonne, then we'll take a break. I've got a bunch of other things I want to cover here in the limited time we have. Hi, Carl.
Hi there. How are you?
Good.
No one's mentioned the word nitric oxide. Back in 1998, three doctors won the Nobel Prize for discovering that the body can make nitric oxide, and that will reduce your blood pressure. And there are things on the market, L-arginine, L-citrulline, that the sports people seem to know about, but the doctors don't seem to understand. And it would have saved my wife about 5 years ago. So.
Huh. Who wants to tackle that? Dr. Thompson.
So one of the problems with these supplements that supposedly raise nitric oxide is that the effect diminishes over time. So that there's when you start taking some of these things like L-arginine, and we've studied these, and nitric oxide simply didn't come up because it's not something you usually talk about on a radio show. But when you take and you use L-arginine, for example, for a period of time, the effect dissipates very quickly. So I hate to say this, but you know, a lot of things that are sold as supplements and over the counter and whatever, they're less interested in your health than they are in selling supplements.
Did you want to expand on that, Dr. Mann?
Yeah, first I would just quickly say that one of those three Nobel Prize winners, Dr. Furchtgott, was a teacher of mine, a wonderful gentleman. And it was dramatic and important findings. And I agree with what Dr. Thompson said. And what's interesting is if you look at the beta blockers, there are traditional beta blockers, and there's also a new beta blocker that increases the level of secretion of nitric oxide in addition to being a beta blocker. And if you look at a beta blocker that is just a beta blocker and a beta blocker that's a beta blocker plus increased nitric oxide, guess what? The blood pressure is the same. Now, the beta blocker with the nitric oxide, there's more dilation, lowers the peripheral resistance in the arteries, so hemodynamically, it's an advantage. But in terms of blood pressure lowering, the long-term effect of nitric oxide, as Dr. Thompson was saying, is not large and can be questioned if it's significant.
Yeah, one more thing from Dr. Thompson.
So, Colin, and Carl, the other thing that you need to remember is one of the best ways to increase all those enzymes that make nitric oxide is to go for a good brisk walk. It's been shown repetitively, looking at coronary arteries, that there's increased levels of nitric oxide with exercise training.
We're going to take a quick break here. I want to talk more about the so-called mind-body connection. This is a complicated thing, and it isn't even necessarily the thing that you think it is. So we'll take a break. We'll come back after this. Consciousness is losing the fight.
Took alpha blockers and beta blockers, and now I keep losing at Scrabble. Today's show was produced by Betsy Kaplan and me. Our intern is Tess Aronson. The part of Bill Curry was played by Joe Montana. Greg Hill tweets for us at WNPR Colin and appeared in the intro. For photos, links, stories, and a brand new column by legendary jazz critic Owen McNally, visit our website, WNPR.org. Tomorrow we rebroadcast our show about moon rocks. And now, back to Colin.
Yes, I'm flying away for a few days. I have to go to a wedding in San Francisco, so we'll have a couple of our favorite shows on the air for you. I'll be back next week. We're talking about cardiovascular health, about high blood pressure, about American Heart Association guidelines today. We're talking to two people about these things, Dr. Paul Thompson, who's chief of cardiology at Hartford Hospitals, Dr. Samuel Mann, a professor of clinical medicine specialist in hypertension at New York Presbyterian Weill Cornell Medical Center. He's the author of Hypertension and You. Dr. Mann, I'm going to start with you on this. One of the things you explore, well, let me just sort of back up, okay? So there's an old joke about high blood pressure, which is, you know, a guy goes to his doctor and he says, I've got high blood pressure, it's in my family. And the doctor says, is it on your mother's side or your father's side? He goes, oh, no, it's on my wife's side. And he says, well, that's impossible. And the guy says, oh, no, you should meet her family. And so, you know, that's everybody's idea of the mind-body connection of hypertension, that things that upset you raise your blood pressure, which is true. But when you talk about the mind-body connection, you're not really talking about, you're talking about a different kind of connection that may be elevating blood pressure in a way that people are less conscious of.
Right. The common belief is that stress and anger and anxiety raise your pressure repeatedly and lead ultimately to sustained hypertension. And that's very widely believed. For 50 years, they're trying to prove that in studies. The fact that they're still trying to prove that 50 years later is telling us something. And in my experience and in the literature, it doesn't. And does it raise blood pressure in the moment? Absolutely. If somebody gets nervous, does their pressure go up in the moment? Yes. And that's why people think it is a cause of hypertension. But the studies are clear. And if you look at meta-analyses of many studies, they just do not find a connection. And interestingly, the guy that gets angry and shouts at people might have, if anything, a lower pressure than the person who doesn't. Well, then, what is the mind connection in hypertension? And as I would say, in 90% of cases, hypertension is not related to the mind-body, with also the complication that people who get nervous at the doctor's office think they have hypertension, and many of them are treated because of that and unnecessarily. Where I think the mind-body connection is, and it's a fascinating different connection, and I'll explain it by giving an example. Two people live through a severely abusive childhood, abuse, trauma, however you want to describe it. Two siblings who are otherwise the same. They come out of it, one of them, the rest of his life, he's depressed, he's anxious. The other one is calm and happy and goes on to a nice, happy life. Which of those two is more likely to develop hypertension? In my experience, it's the calm, happy one. And probably related to the fact that the emotions have not had any expression. It's not like he's saying, I'm angry, but I won't show it. He doesn't even know he's angry. That's the guy who's more likely to have hypertension, and I see this again and again and again. And the main point I want to make, that's not psychopathology. That's the ability, without even knowing it, to get the troubling aftermath, emotional aftermath, out of consciousness without our even knowing it. It's a survival advantage psychologically. I think evolution gave it to us as a very important defense, but one of the after effects of it can be hypertension.
Well, now, how do you find that person? And I think we said at the beginning, this group of patients, it represents 10% of the patient population. How do you find that person, and how do you treat that person?
Right. How do I find them? if I have a patient who's been through a pretty rough life, and I ask a question of almost every patient, do you ever suffer from anxiety or depression? And that guy says no. That's a red flag. It's that kind. He's not feeling it, because everybody gets down from time to time, and especially somebody who's had a rough life. The other thing is the disparity between the story somebody tells you and how they are. And there's one particular form of hypertension which is almost always mind-body, and that's something called paroxysmal hypertension, meaning episodic hypertension. Pressure's normal, and out of nowhere they have a bout of severe blood pressure elevation with headache, lasts for a few hours, goes away, and the person gets attacks again and again and again. Almost everybody has a story, and I know to look for that story. How do I treat it? For the hypertensive patient, I would think about drugs like alpha blockers and beta blockers, which block the effect of the sympathetic nervous system. They are more effective for that. In somebody with episodic hypertension, I use the alpha and beta blockers, and sometimes when somebody keeps on having attack after attack, I'll put them on an antidepressant even though they're not depressed, and the attacks go away, which is a bit of proof of concept. So again, that's not the usual form of hypertension, but the treatment is different.
A lot of this stuff is stuff that needs to be covered in more depth and can be covered in more depth in Dr. Main's book, Hypertension in You, which I really do recommend to people. Dr. Paul Thompson, just to sort of come back and kind of round this out, you know, we've talked about brisk walks, but, you know, the other thing I think that a lot of hospitals are exploring through departments of integrative medicine and things like that is, you know, and maybe we're not talking exactly about the dynamic that Dr. Samuel Mann is just talking about, but the fact that people do need to learn how to relax a little bit or do need to know how to monitor their breathing or to do things that take them out of a stress mode. How important is that ultimately to cardiovascular health, and how much of it is just sort of new age mumbo jumbo?
So there is some new age mumbo jumbo to it, but the fact of the matter is that there's been smoke from this area for so long that there's probably some fire. It's been very hard to prove, however, that putting people on antidepressants or sending them to counselors actually results in a reduction of their risks of vascular disease. But more importantly is you do want people to have good lives. So simply keeping them alive so that they can be miserable is not really the way to take care of patients. So I think hospitals are interested in this, and cardiologists are interested in this, and cardiac rehab programs for people who have had heart attacks, is that it simply makes people feel better about their overall lives, to have a sense of doing things. And I think that's one of the things that exercise does. Exercise kind of dissipates some of that free-floating hostility that people have, some of the stress that folks have. And the same thing can happen with relaxation therapy. So that's where I think it is. In order to, if you asked me for studies that would prove that these relaxation things result in lower risks of heart disease, I could not pick out the number of studies I could pick out with statins, for example. But there's no doubt about the fact that the head bone is connected to the heart bone.
Dr. Mann, do you want to wrap things up in 30 seconds? We're almost out of time here, but...
Yeah, it's interesting. I have not spoken ever with Dr. Thompson. It's very pleasant how much we agree on everything, and that's not very common. But I think the bottom line is common sense. And when they get into absolutes and cookie-cutter recommendations for every patient, that doesn't work. There is no absolute, and you have to judge each patient as an individual and figure out what's right. And that's what the art of medicine is, and that's what makes it fun, too.
All right. Thanks to both of you. This has been fun in, you know, a very medical way. Dr. Paul Thompson is the chief of cardiology at Hartford Hospital. Dr. Samuel Mann, professor of clinical medicine and specialist in hypertension at New York Presbyterian Weill Cornell Medical Center. Well, I'm getting good at saying that. And the author of Hypertension and You. We'll be back tomorrow. Actually, I won't. I'll be airborne, but you'll be back tomorrow. It's a great show about moon rocks.
I'm Kyle and Wolf, and this whole show has my blood pressure just through the roof, and I don't want to take any meds because then there's side effects, so I think I figured out the best way to handle this. that's the stuff. Oh.